everyone, and welcome to A Minor Podcast, the best podcast in the world about classical music. Today we're dealing with Prokofiev, and especially his the music from a part of music from the ballet Romeo and Juliet, and it will be concerned. It's called Dance of the Knights or Montagues and Capulets, and is about the ballroom scene from Romeo and Juliet. I'm producer Massey, and here's your host, Embi.
Yeah, hi everyone. It's interesting. Prokofiev was one of the biggest composers of this 20th century. He was born in 1891, died in 1953. And he was someone that started off, he was a pianist. And it was kind of quite common at that time to have pianists, and they composed piano works, kind of like we talked about a little bit, Liszt, Rachmaninoff, people like that in the last episode. But he was someone that was actually quite musically gifted, and he ended up going to the Moscow Conservatory of Music when he was very young, and he was kind of looked upon as a bit of a obnoxious young fellow, because he was younger than a lot of his colleagues. And yeah, he would apparently kept statistics on their errors in their class.
So, okay, that will give you the reputation of being obnoxious.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, he wrote like a lot of piano works early on. Like he did a couple of really, really good piano concertos. Modern, breaking out from the traditional harmonies. We kind of brushed on this last week with our eras. This is heading into the modern era, and it's kind of deconstructing the key system. And he was very involved in that. But really, what kind of broke him out of the mold of a composer pianist was he was commissioned to write music for a ballet by Sergei Diaghilev. And he was the founder of the Ballet Russes, which was one of the most innovative ballet companies of the 20th century. And just as a little aside, because everything's kind of connected in this period, it's kind of very interesting to me. The Ballet Russes, it was based in Paris and was active from around 1909 till 1999. And its point was to connect with the young choreographers, the composers, designers, dancers, the up-and-comers, the ones who were kind of on the vanguard of their different fields. And to that end, Diaghilev commissioned works from not just Prokofiev, but Stravinsky, Debussy, Satie, Ravel. He wanted set designs and things from people like Kandinsky and Picasso. And it got costume designs from Coco Chanel. So it was very much a multimedia format. And this is kind of how Prokofiev kind of started off his foray into more than just piano music, really.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know he had that much hands-on. In the production of the ballets he was involved with, I always figured he was just, in quote unquote, the composer of them, really.
Oh yeah, no, he was just commissioned by the person who invented or who created the Ballet Russe.
Okay, my bad.
So really, the guy who had his the guy who had all his kind of fingers in all the pies, as it were, was the Russian guy, Sergei Diaghilev. And he was, although Ballet Russes, it was run by Russian, it was very much interested in putting forward tales, music, and designs, design motifs drawn from Russian folklore. But they never actually performed in Russia. They were based in Paris. So it's kind of, but they were just very important bringing composers to the forefront in kind of a different context, in the ballet context. And as I say, it was kind of that. But yeah, Prokofiev was one that the guy really, really liked him and really liked his music. And I think he commissioned 3 ballets total from him. Yeah. And that really kind of pushed him forward musically.
It's interesting that they're based in Paris, but has such an interest in Russian folklore at the time. I mean, I'm thinking, does communism play a part here? I mean, communists weren't always too keen on a national identity linked to such things as folklore and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a part of it. And also, especially later on with the communism, where there was specific rules of how they wanted art to be portrayed. So if you're kind of doing contemporary stuff and trying to push out the boat and do different things, that was kind of frowned upon because it didn't really fit the mold of what was trying to be portrayed to the rest of the world at large. So I think that's kind of why they're a little bit exiled out of the Soviet Union.
Had to do it somewhere else if they wanted to do it at
all.
Sorry, go ahead.
As I said, the founder of it being a Russian, you know, he obviously wanted to bring parts of his history and his nation. So that's why there was a lot of that in the works that were produced.
Yeah. It's interesting about the Romeo and Juliet ballet. There are a general, I wouldn't say joke, but it is said with a loving touch about the moodiness of Russian composers and Russian art in general, be it music, literature, visual arts, what have you. It is a bit doom and gloom sometimes, often.
Yes, it is. Mostly. It is quite often doom and gloom.
And in this instance, I know that Prokofiev had actually done an alternative ending to Romeo and Juliet.
Yes.
In this ballet form, a happy ending, which kind of sparked controversy at best.
Yes, definitely. It's interesting, actually, because this ballet was written in, I think, 1935, and it was kind of difficult for getting it actually onto the stage. And again, Prokofiev is one of the very celebrated Russian composers. He originally actually left Russia after the revolution in 1917, and he lived in the United States, he lived in Germany, he lived in Paris for a bit, and he eventually settled back into the Soviet Union at this point. And he settled back, is that like 1936? Those are my notes here. And part of the problems he was having as well abroad was in America, he couldn't get a lot of performances because they had the Great Depression. So that kind of diminished a lot of opportunities for, you know, performances and things like that. Another thing, he was earning a living playing as a pianist, and he broke his hand. So that kind of, you know, his life is kind of a little bit like a Russian novel, actually.
Yeah.
But so he ends up, he moves back to the Soviet Union, and they commissioned a lot of new music for him, especially Romeo and Juliet, again, the piece we're talking about today. But it was kind of, it was originally supposed to be produced and performed by the Bolshoi Theater, but then it was cancelled. And there's a little bit of question whether this was to do with Shostakovich, who's another great Russian composer, but who I think creatively was stifled under communism.
Yeah.
And he had just produced a ballet, and there was a lot of controversy about that because of the modernistic music and themes and stuff. So
he was
that's
out.
One of the theories. But yeah, there's a few different theories. There was the ballet being undanceable was one of the theories, which you see that's not really true because people dance it today. or the happy ending was kind of a problem as well. So there was a lot of different reasons why it was having trouble getting performed. It ended up actually being performed with the original Shakespeare ending, which is not particularly happy.
And not exactly, no.
And that was premiered in Czechoslovakia. Although Prokofiev couldn't attend it because he wasn't allowed to leave the Soviet Union. So it's been kind of a rocky road getting it onto the stage.
But it was worth the wait.
Yes. Well,
he might not know that now, but it is one of the most recognizable pieces of music from the modern classical repertoire.
Yeah.
Without
and it's
doubt.
Amazing because you.
Yes.
Yeah, but you look and see all the different uses of it. It's always used. If there's something about Russian, that's always used. You know what I mean? It's such a recognizable piece, and it has such a distinctive theme and a distinctive time and geography. I think. I think one of my favorite comments that I saw on YouTube was someone said, "I bet this is what Putin's alarm clock sounds like." I like that one.
I wouldn't be surprised. He does have a sense of grandeur. It is a mighty powerful piece of music. And I've touched upon this before because actually this is probably my all-time favorite piece of classical music. I'm very much into the massive, basically the evilness of this, the evil majesty that this piece possesses. It is so powerful. It is so enormous. It is so grand. It is so intense. It is perfect. In my humble opinion, and I remember I think I've mentioned before, the first time I actually heard this piece of music was, I may have been like 8, 9, perhaps 10 years old, and it was at that time I had the classic Commodore 64 computer, there was a big cracking scene, you know, people buying original games and then cracking the protection on it so they could copy it and distribute it. And most of these, whether they were single per individuals or groups of crackers doing this, almost all of them added a cut scene of some kind, telling the world this game was cracked by this guy or this team or whatever.
And
often with some of this lovely 8-bit music on it. And it was on one of these cracking cutscenes that I actually first heard this, an 8-bit version of it. And it was the most awesome thing I had heard even then.
Yeah.
However, I didn't have a title. I didn't have anything on it. And sometimes I would, of course, come across it later, but again, never had a title, nothing to go on. And I mean, I was 10 years old in 1990. This is way before internet and YouTube and all that. There was no easy way to do that. I couldn't Shazam it on my smartphone or anything. And then I think maybe around perhaps 20 years old, so that's too long ago for me to even mention, I'm doing the classic tradition of zapping through channels on the TV before the TVs were smart. And I come across, I zap past a ice skating competition. And the music there was this piece. And I'm pretty sure it was ice skating, actually. That wasn't important, but I stayed and I listened because, oh my God, this is so amazing. Of course, I was living with my dad at the time. No one was home, so there was no one, you know, have you heard this before or anything? No, no. But then, as stroke of luck, the commentator actually mentions the title of the piece.
Oh, and you were like, hallelujah.
Yeah, and it was straight, okay, I'm out of here. The library is still open. We had a great library, a giant, a huge music section. Down there, tell the librarian what I needed. He found it, and I, you know, could sit down and listen to it. And it was everything I wanted it to be and more. I knew it was great. I had never expected how magnificent it actually was. And it was so good.
Yeah. Coming from like an 8-bit version of it and then coming with the whole orchestra and the bass trombones and the horns and the strings and the whole thing's like...
And also remembering this piece for over 10 years and not knowing it, but I had never forgotten about it. So it was absolutely one of the most satisfying things I've ever tried.
Yes. Oh, I love that. That's the thing. I mean, just a little aside, but I know we kind of rant a little bit about technology on here sometimes. But it's the thing of the olden days where you would have to hunt down a record or a piece at the library or a friend, or you'd have to really hunt stuff out, and it just made it all the more special than just like, okay, click, download, done. Stuff like that, and it really makes the piece seem even more than it is because of all the kind of work you put into finding it.
Yes.
And I love that stuff. That was
to continue the rant, this is what I miss about having a local record shop.
Yes.
Because it's one thing that YouTube or Spotify, whatever, can recommend other music because it is tagged in the same sense or same tags or as genre or whatever. But sometimes it is the human touch of it. Oh, you like this artist?
Exactly.
Well, try this one. I know it's not obviously, there's an obvious link, but it has the same feel to it, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. It might not fit in the algorithm, but
But humanly, emotionally, it fits.
Exactly.
I miss that. I really miss that. So, but we should play some music real soon, actually.
Yes, we should. Can I just say one last thing about the life of Prokofiev that
you can kind of
really.
A lot of things.
Well, because firstly, like some of his works did actually end up getting banned under communism because they did not have the correct. What was called it was a state-sanctioned artistic style known as socialist realism.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be lifelike, representational, and uplifting. And some of his things, because of his harmonies and his rhythmic structures, were, again, modern, forward-looking, and That was frowned upon. So I think they banned 9 of his pieces. So, you know, that wasn't particularly good. And then he ended up, when he died on the same day that Stalin died. So there was obviously 3 days of funeral, I don't want to say celebrations, that's the wrong word, but funeral, maybe not, but yeah, funeral.
Preparations?
Thing. Yeah, there was, yes, it was 3 days of mourning Stalin, and Prokofiev, who actually lived near Red Square at the time, literally got his coffin kind of carried out the back door, and ended up being, there's about 30 people at his funeral, one of which was Shostakovich, which makes sense with them both having trouble with the state-sanctioned composer and artist style at the time. So, yeah, that was the end of Prokofiev's life, was dying on the same day as Stalin and ending up kind of, while not necessarily having a pauper's funeral like Mozart, it was a very small affair and really not fitting for the great genius that the guy was.
No, but that's how it goes with far too many artists. There is really something to the... to the cliche that a good artist is always underappreciated by his contemporaries, by his time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's sad. Yeah. It's sad. But yes.
Yeah.
Well, this particular part of the piece, we're not going to play the entire ballet, of course. No. So this is a small excerpt of it, and this is. In the story of Romeo and Juliet, this is where Romeo, Mercutio, and Benvolio are attending the Capulet ball. Romeo is, at this point, he is sort of has a good eye to what's he called, Rosaline. Of the house Capulet. Yeah. And at this ball, this is where he first meets Juliet. So the first part of the music is this very grand, the very recognizable part of it. It represents the Capulets, who was a fighting house, so to speak, and so it has the grandeur of it, and then there's this beautiful middle piece of it that is meant to portray Romeo and Juliet's first meeting before we again are reminded that there is conflict here. It is absolutely gorgeous.
What is it? A plague on both their houses, I believe, is one of the quotes from Shakespeare. Because the Montagues and the Capulets did not get along.
Not really.
It's a very interesting. It's a foreboding piece and a foreboding scene in the ballet because it's this. It's interesting because it's this very formal ballroom scene, but it's just a very, let's say, foreboding music of like all is not going to end well here.
No, but it still represents the awe of the knights of the house Capulet. It's amazing. So let's listen to some music, shall we?
Yes, let's.
Thank you.
It's incredible.
That is just perfect. I almost need a cigarette. Anyway, where to start? I absolutely, of course, the theme of it. It is an amazing sound it has. It is an amazing. It's so imposing.
Yes.
And
it's that strong kind of pulsating beat that comes, you know, from the strings and the brass at the beginning. That boom, yes. boom, boom, boom. You know, that really kind of sets the scene for it, and that low brass really just nails that.
It really creates a massively solid foundation for this theme to unfold upon.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to this very, very delicate, these very delicate midsections.
Yes. Where
we have the flute and the woodwinds. It's just such an amazing contrast between the two.
And, yeah.
And even if you don't know the story that goes on, you know there's a story going on here. It is incredibly narrative in its structure. And,
yes,
and you can hear this kind of music is also where the modern film score composers have drawn so much inspiration.
Oh yes.
Because some of this you can almost hear parts of what John Williams has done in Indiana Jones, the soundtrack for Indiana Jones. There's some of these
dissonance. This piece is entirely Darth Vader's theme tune. This is like, if you listen to those on top of each other, it fits absolutely perfectly. Like right down to, you watch it with the film, and right down to the metronome marking of where the film hits. It's like John Williams literally just, okay, I'm going to take this piece and I'm just going to change the notes around a bit, and there it is.
Well, he had good taste then.
Oh, yes. John Williams knew what he was doing in that regard. Because it makes sense, because it is, again, that foreboding, the warrior kind of theme going on. Yes. And it makes sense that you would use that to push the narrative, like in Star Wars or Indiana Jones or, you know, a lot of movies.
Yes, because the Capulets are still portrayed as, in a sense, the bad guys here.
Yeah.
And that is solely because we have Romeo from the House Montague. But it is, if we step back, it is kind of hard to really determine who are the good guys and who are the bad guys in this.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is simply in the sense of Romeo being the main protagonist, that means the Capulets are the bad guys.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, a narrative always has to have a good guy or a bad guy. You know, versus good versus evil is always the classic kind of narrative that's been from generations and centuries of.
Yeah.
Mozart, Shakespeare, you know, he wrote this, and it was in the 1500s. It was a long time ago, and of course, this is all built on tales from the beginning of time, basically from the beginning of people sitting around fires back before we even had written word and things, and just oral traditions and these tales all passed down, and it's always the good versus evil, the hero, you know, like we talked about a little bit with the Wagner, and it's the hero's journey, and of course
we gotta know who to root for in this. Otherwise, we're going to spend all the time we should be listening to a good story, you know, starting to contemplate like morality and stuff like that. Ain't nobody got time for that.
Yeah, exactly.
We want to hear a good story. That's what we came for.
Exactly. And I think that's
the way that the theme here with the strings and the low brass presents the grandeur of the house Capulet at this ball, and then we have this very delicate piece that shows the budding romance between Romeo and Juliet, who, by the way, don't waste any time. They meet here, and the same night they declare their undying love for each other at the famous balcony scene. This is a but of course, I mean, if it goes back to a time that's older than when Shakespeare wrote it, we had an average age of what, 35? That wasn't time to wait.
Yeah, exactly.
So, let's get on with this.
But it's interesting, though, just to talk a little bit about like the instrumentation that Kevier used, because it's like you said, the opening kind of theme with the heavy brass and the strings really kind of playing really aggressively, I guess you could say. And then when it opens out into like kind of what I guess would be the B section, and it's marked very quietly. It has flutes, which are, you know, considered more of a romantic area instrument. It actually has a celesta in it, which is kind of a it's kind of a cross between a keyboard and maybe a glockenspiel. So it has a kind of it's a higher pitch kind of metallic-y keyboard instrument.
Yes,
and it has a very, again, it's not used very much in orchestral works at all. And so, you know, that brings another level of the kind of lightness and, again, the contrast with that heavy brass.
Yeah.
And then also when they bring back the main theme, it's done in a softer manner. And it's actually played, we were talking about when we're listening to the active listening, we were talking about pieces that had a saxophone in it. This actually has a saxophone. It's a tenor saxophone that reprises that main theme.
Okay.
But it's just done in a lighter manner than the beginning.
And I would suspect either muted trumpet or something of the sorts, because when the theme is first revisited in the middle of this in this B section, it is in a very muted form. It's very soft. It's much more.
It's tender, kind of.
It's tender. Yes, that would probably be a good word. It is cautious, and I would think, not knowing the ballet that incredibly well, to be honest, but I would think this might be where we have. What's he called? Tybalt?
Yes.
Where he discovers these, because of course our protagonist and his friends here, they show up to the ball in disguise.
Yes.
So I would surmise that this is where Tybalt discovers that there are Montagues at the Capulet ball, and he's not satisfied with that. He's not happy about it.
Yeah, and then that's when it kind of builds back up from the tender reprise of the theme to that kind of dramatic ending that it does have. And that, you know, when the strings come back in and it hits that kind of like, okay, this is not cool, guys. And we know that there's going to be some rough times ahead, let's say.
This is absolutely. I think this will always be one of my favorite pieces of it. This is of the classical world altogether. It just has everything I'm looking for. We're going to be revisiting another one of my absolute favorites at a later time by Friedrich Kühlau. But that's for a later time.
Yes. That's for it's such an excellent piece, and it's just very interesting, like looking at its context, especially when it was written, where it was written, and the kind of political turmoil of the time, and just like how such a great piece of music, you know, can be kind of pushed aside at the time because of a political kind of ideology, basically. Yeah. It's just very interesting. But when we hear it with fresh ears, we're just like, wow, that's absolutely amazing.
I still think it's kind of hilarious that there was, you know, halfway a revolt over him creating a happy ending to Romeo and Juliet. It's like, no, we want our doom and gloom, damn it.
Yes. exactly. it's just crazy, kind of. This old classical music, it has so many, like we hear the pieces today, and just all throughout history, the stories behind how they were created, what they went through, the composers, to get these things realized, their lives, everything. I just find it all so fascinating. The music itself, of course, is wonderful, but like looking into the lives of composers is something that just entertains me to no end.
Yeah, because as we talked about before, we are presented usually with a very formalized version of them, as if they were these larger than life characters who, you know, would live in their giant mansions and then one day emerge, I have created, and then a perfect piece would be played somewhere, and they would be adored and whatnot for it, but often these pieces were tried out, they were adjusted, they were revisited, all kinds of things before ending up with the structure and form we know them today.
Yeah, and a lot of composers were under the rule of, you know, back, you know, we've talked about with the monarchy and the court composers and stuff back in the 17th, 18th century. Of course, into the 20th century, we have a different type of, in this instant with like the communism and the Soviet Union and a different master, as it were. It might not be a king, but you're still being hampered by someone else's whims and desires, basically. Yeah. So it's just very interesting and just how they, composers, got around all this stuff, and they just still ended up creating these brilliant works, and it's just something that I am really fascinated by.
Well, everyone works with what they have. That's what we do.
Just a little aside, the interesting story about Messiaen, who's another 20th century composer, and he, one of his most famous pieces of music was Quartet for the End of Time, and he's a French composer, and he was actually in a concentration camp, and like they provided him with basically enough for a string quartet, and it was like the cello was missing a string, and you know everything was kind of out of tune and kind of, but he still composed this great piece of music, and it was just a you know, like, again, you work with what you have, with your situation, and it's just some fascinating kind of stories out there of music.
That is definitely fascinating. Anyway, I was really, really happy to do this particular episode. This track is just so amazing, and I'm actually gonna, I've never watched the ballet in its entirety. I think I'm going to do something about that, because I'd actually like to see it.
Yeah,
play
to see
out.
The context.
Yes, see the entire thing play out as
yeah,
it's meant to.
That's all.
So, I guess that's it for this time then.
Yep, I think we have done a good job of vocabulary here.
We have done the damage that we could.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, and so next week we will be visiting another Russian composer, Rachmaninoff, and in particular the track "The Isle of the Dead." So, you know, more doom and gloom.
Yes.
Anyway, that's it. That's it for this time. This was your host MP, and I'm producer Massey. Please do like, share, subscribe, all that, whatever you can think of. Messenger, pigeons, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
It all works. Until next time, have fun.